The headlines: Iran summons the UK ambassador to voice its vehement protests at Britain's latest sanctions. Russia is pledging to take adequate countermeasures if the US and Western states continue to escalate the situation in Ukraine. Plus, a senior U.S. senator is urging the government to freeze security cooperation with Saudi Arabia. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Iranian foreign ministry has once again summoned the British ambassador to express its strong condemnation of the UK's, quote, interventions in Iran's internal affairs. The foreign ministry says that Iran considers Britain's arbitrary sanctions as totally worthless and reserves the right to take reciprocal action. The UK imposed sanctions on Iran over what it called the violation of human rights during the recent riots in the country. The UK's sanctions target a number of Iranian police and political security officials. The blacklisting will bar the individuals from traveling to the UK. The bans came after similar sanctions by the US. Tehran has slammed Washington's move by calling it the backbone of American-style human rights. The Russian military has struck several Ukrainian cities, including the capital, Kiev, with over 80 cruise missiles in the first such strikes in months. The Ukrainian officials say that the attacks had targeted western and central cities, left at least 11 people dead and more than 60 others wounded. Large swaths of the country are now left without power. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is targeting Ukrainian people and infrastructure with the aim of wiping his country off the face of the earth. His Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin says, however, that the strikes against the Ukrainian Energy Command and communications targets were in response to what he called Ukraine's terrorist attack on the Crimea Bridge on Saturday.
If attempts to carry out acts of terrorism on our territory continue, Russia's response will be harsh and its scale will correspond to that of the threat made against the Russian Federation. No one should be in any doubt about that.
Russia's defense ministry says all designated targets in Ukraine were hit by missiles. The reactions to the strikes are now pouring in. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has condemned the attacks, calling them an unacceptable escalation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has stressed Washington's support for Ukraine, saying it will continue to provide unwavering economic, humanitarian, and military assistance to Ukraine. EU leaders have also pledged more military aid to Ukraine. France and Germany have said that they are offering support in line with what they call Kiev's military needs. Germany says it will soon deliver an air defense system to Ukraine. Russia has vowed to respond to Western countries' growing involvement in the Ukraine conflict. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov is warning that the U.S. and NATO should realize, in his own words, the danger of uncontrolled escalation in Washington and other Western capitals. Rybakov made the comments after Washington and its Western allies said they will continue to support Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden has vowed to provide Ukraine with advanced air defense systems. He made the pledge after Russia conducted its largest missile attack against Ukraine since the start of the war. Washington has been a key supplier of arms to the country since the beginning of the war with Russia in February. The value of the U.S. military stands to close to $17 billion. The European Commission announces plans for Ukraine to join the EU's long-term budget, suggesting the Ukrainian government would receive 3.5 billion euros per month to keep the state functioning. Meanwhile, the EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell warns the world is heading for a recession due to rising inflation and interest rates. Jerem Hughes reports.
The 2022 EU Ambassadors Conference was launched on Monday in Brussels against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine and its global consequences. Ambassadors from the EU's 145 delegations and offices around the world took part.
This is a perfect storm. First, prices increasing. Everybody's running to increase interest rates. This will bring us to a world recession.
Tensions between the West and Russia are rising. One official in Moscow claims a truck was used to attack the Crimean Bridge last Saturday and had travelled through EU nation Bulgaria. The European Commission was asked to respond.
There are so many things coming out of Moscow and from these official so-called places which don't really merit any commentary. I mean, let me recall that the Crimea is Ukraine.
No one has yet claimed responsibility, but some analysts say the move was a strategic mistake.
The threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming more and more real. And I think it wasn't wise, it was really provocative to attack the bridge, especially military. Whoever did it, they haven't reached any significant result because the bridge resumed functioning the very same day.
12 months ago, EU agency the European Court of Auditors determined Ukraine is corrupt to the core. Despite this, the nation is set to become part of the EU's long-term budget. The European Commission says Kiev needs 3.5 billion euro per month to run the country.
Since the beginning of the war, we have supported Ukraine financially with Esteem Europe with up to 19 billion euros. This is not including the military capability and equipment support.
Fighting intensified on Monday as Russia's military struck Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. The latest position from the West's perspective is due to become clearer later this week when a meeting of NATO defence ministers takes place here in the Belgian capital. Also, an EU leaders' summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The French government threatens to intervene to end a weeks-long refinery strike that have led to major fuel shortages across the country. Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire says that the government will not allow the blockades on refineries to last. The government also says striking workers could be requested to go back to work. The industrial action over the workers' payments has taken 60% of French refining capacity offline. This has led to fuel shortage and a third of gas stations nationwide where long lines have been formed. The strike action has hit refineries run by Total Energies and ExxonMobil. The walkout has worsened the energy crisis and inflation in France due to Russia's war in Ukraine. Calls are growing louder in the U.S. Congress to punish Saudi Arabia over its decision to lower oil production and raise prices. A senior U.S. senator is now calling for an immediate freeze on cooperation with the kingdom, including most arms sales. Senator Bob Menendez says the U.S. must limit arms sales and security cooperation to what is absolutely necessary to defend U.S. personnel and interests. Three U.S. legislators have already introduced a bill to withdraw troops and missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia. The kingdom is the largest oil producer in OPEC Plus. The oil alliance has announced an output cut by 2 million barrels per day from November. That could push up gasoline prices in the U.S. ahead of the midterm elections next month. It also hinders U.S. efforts to restrict Russia's oil revenues over the war in Ukraine. We talked to Scott Bennett, a former U.S. psychological warfare officer, about Saudi Arabia's options regarding the situation.
You know, I think this is a very interesting opportunity to ironically reset the relationship between Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, because with the U.S. becoming increasingly desperate and fanatical, frantic, and irrational, you have the opportunity for Iran to make overtures to Saudi Arabia and say, in this multipolar world that's developing, and with the U.S. Doubling down on its global war of hegemony, let Iran and Saudi Arabia use Russia as a middleman for settling some of the tensions and conflicts so that Saudi Arabia feels it has the room to maneuver and perhaps set up a new political orientation towards the BRICS and Shanghai Development, Shanghai Cooperation Group. I think Iran and Russia have an opportunity to bring Saudi Arabia more into their orbit. And I think this is the effect that is going to also replicate in Europe as nations reject the terroristic war of empire that the globalists led by Joe Biden and Ursula von Leyen and Liz Truss and Macron and all of the rest of these globalist types, as the real world, which is India, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, as all of these nations begin to recoagulate and form more of a multipolar front.
Despite decades of Iranophobia, the new poll shows that the average American is incredibly supportive of the diplomacy in Iran. 4 out of 5 Americans think Washington should pursue negotiations with Iran, but the administration of Joe Biden has continued with his predecessor's maximum pressure sanctions campaign on the Iranian people. Ramin Mazari reports.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, you know, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas, and, you know, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, you know, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters. Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran. From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites. However, the poll seems to prove that these messages have been emphatically rejected by the average American.
The level of sway that the defense industry has over Washington, the defense lobby and the military-industrial complex, that's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support as diplomacy with Iran was that 80% of Americans demand more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Thousands of Muslims have celebrated the birthday of Prophet Muhammad in the UK towns in the weekend. Said Purza reports the joyous occasion is a change to revisit the Prophet's legacy and set right misconceptions about the religion of Islam among non-Muslims.
Dressed in their Sunday's best and singing words of praise, thousands of Muslims from around the world descended upon the northwest English town of Bolton to celebrate a historical figure whose legacy transcends time and space. Prophet Muhammad, his birthday called the Maulid, celebrated in the third month of the Islamic calendar.
For these Muslims and millions of others around the world, Prophet Muhammad is an ethical and spiritual role model, and commemorating his life is another way of keeping his memory alive in the collective Muslim consciousness.
And it is that and his many other characteristics which attract these Muslims to the joyous occasion. The young are eager to tell us what the Prophet means to them.
Inspiration, and undoubtedly the most honest person you can ever think of, the best of all mankind, and the one you should actually truly believe in. Like, you can say, I believe in this person because he's a good man, good job. This person is the one you can really say, and with your heart and faith, say, I believe in him.
He means everything to me. He showed me how to live my life, how to treat other people. You know, how the way I'd want to be treated is the same way I treat other people.
As well as making the Prophet and his legacy a constant in the lives of Muslims, the event sets out to change misconceptions among non-Muslims in the wake of insults against the Prophet in Europe in recent years and increased religious hate crimes on his followers.
Our religion that the beloved Prophet Muhammad has given it is a religion of peace, love and harmony, and it's to build unity and community, to bring the communities together with love and harmony.
At the same time as their female counterparts celebrating in a nearby building, the men engage in prayers and reciting the Quran. Said Puriza, Bolton.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we briefly spoke about Imam Khomeini's first days in Nofel Le Chateau, a village around Paris, and the way his family, especially his wife, Ms. Sarafi, would handle the affairs in that village. Today we are going to continue the story. Stay with us, please. As we had said earlier, the Shah of Iran fled the country on January 16, 1979, and arrived in Aswan of Egypt. The news of his escape soon reached Paris, making Imam Khomeini's companions and many of the foreign journalists happy. Everyone was waiting for the Imam's reaction, but he only said, "Well," and there was no change in his face. The four-month period of Imam Khomeini's stay in France was a good opportunity to clarify and proclaim the Islamic Revolution's message to the world. Imam Khomeini used to make relations with religious people and arouse their sentiments in favor of the Iranian oppressed people. For instance, on the occasion of the new Gregorian year and the birthday of Prophet Jesus, the Imam sent a message to the Christians of the world and called Jesus as the reviver of the dead and the awakener of the sleep. He also called for the world Christians to pray for the Iranian nation. He wrote in his message, "I ask you, the Christian community, in your blessed days, to pray for our nation, which is caught by the unjust king, and appeal to God for their salvation. I ask you to warn the heads of some of the Christian countries who support the oppressive Shah with their satanic power and smash a nation under the pressure of oppression and make them familiar with the teachings of Prophet Jesus. I ask the Christian clergy to advise the heads of some of the powerful countries and denounce their support for those who have turned their back to the heavenly teachings." As Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued his message to the world Christians, his wife entered the scene of political activities more seriously. She says, "I had no specific duty in Nofelo Chateau until the Imam sent congratulatory message to the world Christians. As I was somehow aware of his Gnostic views, I felt it as a duty to elucidate the Imam's opinion so that some people would not think he had done a merely political job." Ms. Saqafi speaks about her life with Imam Khomeini. "In those days, I spent almost 100 hours in solitude and reviewed my life. I thank God more than 1,000 times for marrying a person whose thoughts are updated the older he becomes." As the Shah had escaped, the entire Iranian nation was waiting for the Imam's return to the country, but this decision faced many problems and obstacles. The Shah's premier was still in power and he might make problems for the Imam. Many of the politicians believed that the Imam's flight might be dangerous, while others maintained that he should return to the country as his presence among the people would accelerate the revolution's victory. Finally, Imam Khomeini made his mind to return to the country and Haj Ahmad made the preparations for his trip. Thus, one night, he told his companions in Nofelo Chateau, "Once again, I apologize to all and I will soon go to Iran. There is the possibility of some dangers in this trip. Thus, I don't want anyone be at risk for my sake. I and Ahmad will go. If we reach Iran with no problem, we will meet each other in Iran, God willing. And if there is a danger for me, you should be present to continue the struggle." One of the attendants said, "You mean that you are not intent to take ladies in this trip? Was there no woman with Imam Hussein?" The Imam answered, "Imam Hussein was Imam Hussein. I don't want to accompany the ladies. As for the men also, I said that I don't like anybody to be in trouble for me." Ms. Khadija Saghafi says that the night of Imam Khomeini's farewell was not that hard, as his face was full of faith in God. She says, "It was not hard because by seeing the Imam's face, I was sure that there would be no problem for him and his companions. I was sad that I couldn't accompany him, yet I knew that if I accompanied him in the plane and Tehran, his attention would partly be drawn toward me. So I understood that if I do not accompany the Imam, he would be more comfortable and would not have any concern about me. However, I knew that his departure would make the village silent and gloomy, and I would be sad." Imam Khomeini and his companions landed at Mehrabad Airport in Tehran in the morning of February 2, 1979, and his wife and others joined him within 2 days. We will continue the story in the next episode.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to sanctions, Iran has been a target of Western countries for quite some time, especially the U.S. And now with the most recent protests, which consists of foreign-backed riots, sanctions are raining down on Iran, from Canada's sanctions on Iran's press TV to the IRGC members, to the U.S. and U.K. sanctioning of Iran's police. We ask, does the U.K., or Western countries have the ground to stand on when it comes to human rights or the right to impose sanctions when they are guilty of human rights violations in their own country? And don't their sanctions constitute interference in other countries' affairs? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. He joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us is Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'd like to first start with you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, if I may, and ask you about the UK sanctions, where they have sanctioned Iran's police. And at this point, the quick question that comes about is, does the UK really have a leg to stand on when it comes to the issue of human rights, of which it is basing its sanctions on?
Well, certainly not at a time where Julian Assange is rotting in prison, facing what no one really understands what charges, since the charges from the Swedish lady who initially pressed charges against him have been dropped. And obviously he's being maintained in solitary confinement, which is actually a violation of basic human rights. So just on that element alone, I think Britain doesn't have a leg to stand on. But of course, there are so many other details. For instance, war crimes committed by British soldiers, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, in the way they were treating civilians. So of course, Britain has no leg to stand on. But we're used to seeing Western nations actually lecturing other countries on human rights and on issues such as these, whilst at home or for their own, actually never respecting those very basic human rights that they feel others should abide by.
Sure, Brisby, taking a look at the EU, they have issued a resolution against Iran, and I need to just get justifications from you, and that's why I'm reading off some of the countries or organizations that have leveled sanctions, and in this case, resolution, where it said the resolution criticizes the necessary countermeasures that Iran has taken against the organized acts of violence. Why does the EU feel that it has to come into the picture as a whole and issue a resolution against Iran?
Hello, good evening, Kabul. Obviously, we saw recently one of the Swedish MEP in Brussels cutting her hair. So tonight, I'll be cutting the tie to show that this is the symbol of oppression, which everyone should take off their ties if they want to be part of the resistance movement. Now, coming back to your question, why EU at this time? As our fellow colleague from London quite rightly pointed out, that not only there's hypocrisy and double standards on part of the Britain, but the whole of the European Union, from tiny countries like Lithuania, Estonia, and others in the Baltic and other countries in Europe, they quite often work in cahoots with Washington to put pressure on Iran. As you can remember, even Iran is the country for the last 42 years, the West has been at war with Iran in one form or another, whether it was the eight-year war inflicted on Iran via Saddam in Iraq, or sanctions being applied, or nuclear scientists being assassinated, all kinds of conspiracies and intrigue has been created for the last 42 years. If there were any other nation other than Iran, it would have succumbed by now. The only reason why all these measures are being applied to Iran is that because it does not support the Zionist entity in West Asia. Tomorrow, if the government and the leadership in Iran decides to recognize Israel, then hunky-dory, there is no human rights issue. There are no problems with Iran. Iran would be in the good books of the West. Uh-huh. So the reality is that it's the support for the Palestinians and being part of the resistance and really not recognizing the Zionist state that has created the problem for Iran for the last 42 years. Not pitifully of the death of this particular young lady. That just a decoy to hoodwink the world into thinking that West is on the side of the human rights.
Sympathize strongly with the passing away of the woman is what Iran's president has said. Iran's leader has said that also, that it was a sad thing, Hafsatkar Mustafa. But this is the statement that we continue to hear. We will continue to work with our partners to hold Iranian officials accountable for gross human rights violations. Keep hearing that over and over again, and mostly this comes from the U.S. Is this a line by the U.S. to tell its partners that you should go with the line that we're telling you or asking you so we can all appear as a united front against Iran? Is that what it's trying to do here?
Well, I think at this particular moment in time, I think what the EU and America are trying to do is push Iran in a corner because it's a major gas producer, and they want to make sure that Iran will succumb and will adhere to whatever conditions that are imposed by Western powers when it comes to trading with Iran. So push it in a corner in order for Iran to then be far more compliant. I'd have to say, it's not just about Israel, because the Shah was actually recognized Israel, and at the last minute he was dropped by the West. So Israel is inevitably an element of why the West is constantly against Iran, but it's also a way of maintaining it is a resistance country that hasn't complied in any way to any Western pressure, but it's also the way of keeping pressure because it's a major oil and gas producer, and therefore it's a way of making sure that when you play hot and cold with a country like Iran, you can manage to force it to comply, which it doesn't. Can I just add also that just before the COVID pandemic started, for instance, France had faced major human rights violation issues when it shot and when it maimed scores and hundreds of protesters during the Yellow Vest movement that lasted almost a year, and no sanctions were ever imposed on it, despite major evidence that the police were literally shooting to maim the protesters. So we can see constantly the double standards when it comes to countries such as Iran. And of course, it is basically designed to weaken these countries and to force them to accept whatever terms and conditions is imposed on them in order to allow them to trade more easily.
Iran has come out and said that the internal issue of the Islamic Republic is related to the government and the nation of Iran. Shabir Rizvi, we will not allow any country to interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Where do you think that line was crossed when it came to the reaction by, let's say, the UK or the US or the EU or Germany for that matter?
Well, as I said, the line was crossed when the advent of the Islamic Revolution occurred back 42 years ago. Since then, there have been all kinds of maneuvers that have been used by the West to continuously try to weaken Iran. But the reality is that no matter what methods they use, no matter what sort of technology, I mean, recently, the cyber attacks that have been taking place in Iran is another aspect, plus the use of the social media that is occurring to ignite certain elements of the public to come out on the streets. And the reality is that, like the sister said, that, you know, what happened in France with the Yellow Vest. But the reality is that if you look at the USA, I think the latest figure before coming on to this interview I was looking at, during this year, 1,117 people have been killed in police custody in the USA. So really, you know, how does America and the West have any leg to stand on when they talk about brutality by the Iranian government, when they are not only brutal and commit atrocities on other countries, but they also do the same to their own people if they're standing against, you know. And the thing is, the demonstrations that take place in the West are not really to change the government, not to change the political system. People are usually asking for their basic rights. For instance, over the weekend in UK, there were demonstrations up and down the country in support of, against cost of living, the price of energy. And again, over the weekend, there were demonstrations in Germany, in Holland, in Italy, all over the place, with the cost of living crisis that is facing the West. So when there are demonstrations just for basic needs, those demonstrators are, in a way, beaten up, and all kinds of issues are used. I just want to remind your audience and sort of recap back here in 10 years ago, there were demonstrations in London virtually over the weekend in many, many cities. What happened at that time, hundreds and thousands of people were arrested and got a criminal record. The courts sort of sat overnight to send people into prison. It was a riotous situation. And again, people were demanding, basic rights, not demanding the change of government. If, for example, if the demonstrators did come out in Paris, London, or New York demanding the change of government, then I can see very easily when people were killed at Kent University, 60 years ago demonstrating against Vietnam War. So there's a whole litany of human rights abuses by the West in their own countries against their own people for decades.
Okay, Shabir Rizvi, House of Karim Mustafa, mentions how the media encourages, Shabir Rizvi, correct me if I'm wrong, for people to come out and protest. So usually when they do that, in many instances, if not almost all instances, they are putting that in the context of a video where people are actually vandalizing or setting something on fire. So that's, in a sense, encouraging to incite violence. Now, at the same time, we are looking at the double standards at play here, which I'm trying to understand how they think they can get away with it. When you have, for example, what happened in the protests in London a few weeks back at the Iranian embassy, where protesters, many of them were Iranians, actually clashed with the police in London. Then the Met said, we got to go after them. These people, because some got away, I guess. The Iranians, that is. And there was some pictures that were plastered, kind of like a manhunt. I'm not too sure if they got them yet or not. That approach is okay for London, but not in Iran. In Iran, come out, protest, violence, etc. What do you think about the way that the UK is displaying itself there?
Well, again, I mean, it's been very hypocritical, but it always is. Just to pick up on the other panelists' point, again, there were in 2010, in the harsh winter, which was one of the coldest winters on record, students came out to protest against tuition fees, and the police introduced a method called kettling, which meant that they were kept standing still for 6-7 hours in -4 degrees temperatures, and they couldn't move. And those who tried to move were arrested and were given exemplary sentences up to 4 years for simply attempting to leave the ring and to leave this sort of kettling method. So the brutality, police brutality, whenever anyone takes to the street to protest, even for basic things such as banning tuition fees, is actually repressed in the most violent ways. And yet here you have people actually encouraging Iranians to go out and to break and to commit violent crimes, which is, again, I mean, the hypocrisy is staggering, but we're so used to it. I think people have just become accustomed to it and no longer know what to say. But I think public opinion is not as on board as it used to be. I'd love to say that overall people are seeing through the propaganda, Western propaganda. They're not. But many do realize that there is a double standard. Many have also pointed out the fact that in France, women, for instance, are not allowed to wear the hijab, and no one said anything about the basic human rights of these women. When you see French women sort of cutting their hair as a symbol to support the Iranian women, knowing, can I add, that the current Home Secretary, the Interior Minister of France, has been accused by 4 different women of rape. So when a French woman goes to the police station to complain that she's been a victim of a sexual assault, the boss of the police officers has actually himself been accused of rape by 4 different women. So this is the absolute comical scenario, had it not had such dangerous consequences, that we're currently living. We're living in times of absurdity, and no one can see through it.
Well, the thing that is very alarming here is the way that the approach is being used by certain governments, which is now somewhat coming to light, that there may be political, perhaps, intentions. This is another side to this whole saga, if you may call it, Shabir Rizvi, where you've had certain politicians come out and say, I believe it was the UK Foreign Secretary that came out and said this, that Iran should behave, Iran should not deal with the protests violently, because if it wants, for example, for there to be, and Iran should not go after the nuclear bomb, all within one context, alluding to the fact that Iran should stop this, and along with that, perhaps it might find a way for this JCPOA revival sanctions removal talks to happen, if you know what I'm getting at with this. So are we looking at governments trying to somewhat push Iran, using the protest as a means to get back or to come into the deal that has been worked on for quite some time?
Well, look, if you want me to address the issue of JCPOA, I think that's not really quite fundamental. Whether the JCPOA comes to an agreement or not, that's not an issue. But I think whether it's the UK Foreign Secretary, Mr. Cleverly, or any other Western leader, whenever they get on their pulpit and start preaching to a nation like Iran on human rights abuse, on XYZ, I think they should really look closer home and really try to sort of implement policies which would be in favor of the ordinary people here. Our previous Home Secretary, Priti Patel, passed legislation where even demonstrating would become illegal in the UK. And the current Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, is even sort of extraordinary trying to implement policies of all kinds, whereby they want to send people coming to UK as asylum seekers to Rwanda. So all kinds of different human rights abuses are taking place in the United Kingdom and most of the European countries. So really, at the end of the day, I think all the nations, all the sort of Western nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, European Union, and USA, really should analyze what they are doing themselves. But I dare say, because the reality is that they feel that they are right, they have the arrogance to continue on the same policy, and really they suffer from hubris, to use a phrase which is often used to describe this kind of a situation, when the people who continually speak a lie start believing that lie and think that they are taking the right path. But the reality is that, as our other guest speaker was saying, that I think at least some people, even in the West, are realizing the hypocrisy of their own governments. And I think the cost of living crisis and what's happening with Ukraine will perhaps remove the veils from the eyes of the people, right, who still feel that the West is always right.
I'm going to reflect on a statement made by a former CIA official, Hafsakar Mustafa, if I may, to get your reaction on this, because this relates to what Iran's leader has said, where Bruce Riddell, who was a former CIA official, said, "There's little doubt that there is a covert war that's underway against Iran, and there are at least two players in it. It's the U.S. and the Israel." How much do you think that this statement made by the Bruce Riddell actually applies maybe to what is going on here? Because we know, obviously, in terms of Israel and also in terms of the U.S., this has been going on for quite some time against Iran.
I mean, surprisingly honest coming from a CIA source. But again, I mean, if it's a CIA, he obviously knows what he's talking about. And it's true. Since the Iranian Revolution back in 1979, Iran has been in the firing line of both America and Israel. And it's the only country that has been consistently opposed to any normalization with Israel, has closed the former Israeli embassy, replaced it with a Palestinian embassy. So it's constantly inflicting humiliation upon humiliation, on Israel. And Israel is not accepting this lightly. So, you know, the more Iran resists, the more Israel will apply pressure. And unfortunately, of course, as with many other countries, you have, what Malcolm X refers to as the house slaves, the people who actually are within, inside, and who serve foreign interests. And I think that could be a danger for Iran. But of course, I think that when push comes to shove, Iranians have always showed to rally amongst each other and in support of their government, and always rally against foreign enemies because they know that they're a target. And therefore, even though I think things look worrying at this very moment, if anything, I suspect that when the worst comes to pass, actually Iran will come out of this stronger. And it will come out of this stronger. Why? Because, of course, Europe is about to face a wave of civil unrest over the cost of living crisis. And I think, ironically, it will be the opportunity for many Iranian Twitters and people on social media to then encourage their Western counterparts to do what they're currently doing to Iranian protesters.
Well, here's a good point. And this is really sad, but the differentiation needs to be mentioned again, Shabir Rizvi, and that is the fact that if you had, which I'm sure there were people who were protesting when this protest first broke out, that even though it was not related in their eyes, when they came out to protest to the unfortunate death of that young woman. But they were protesting because they were perhaps economically, were not privileged. You know, they had financial, perhaps, gripes that were plaguing their daily lives. But this protest got stolen once violence kicked in, and once there was rioting, and once there were destruction of property, of which that particular sect of the protesters, that's not what they obviously wanted to promote, to have their voices heard. How do you think, I mean, this is speculation maybe, but how do you think that happened, where that division all of a sudden appeared, and then the ones that were protesting peacefully went out of the picture, and now it's just people who want to vandalize, in a sense. Not all of them still, but a majority of them.
Well, look, at the end of the day, in every country, there are economic issues. And particularly with Iran, when it has been sanctioned for the last 42 years, there will, of course, be issues which would affect a significant number of people. But there are ways of protesting. And also, as President Rouhani has quite rightly pointed out, that demonstrations are permitted in Iran, but violence of this type, killing of the policemen, destruction of property, burning of police cars, in any country, this will not be acceptable. So why should it be acceptable in Iran? But also, you must remember, Kaveh, is that quite often there is a particular segment in each city, whether it's in London, New York, or Washington, or Tehran. There's a richer part of a city and perhaps not that well off. Of course, the richer part of any city are not the barometer of any nation. For example, in London, if you came and asked someone living in Hampstead or Kensington about cost of living crisis, sir, they will have no idea. Similarly, in Iran, if someone living in expensive parts of Tehran will not understand that.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Do appreciate that, though. Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Hazakar Mustafa, pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikael Tarvey and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today is about the act of emotionally hurting someone. Now, this can take on many forms. It can be suddenly cutting contact with somebody, ignoring their calls or messages, and so on and so forth. We just put it under the general term or title name of emotionally hurting someone. Now, we know that in Islam, physically hurting someone or their property is strictly forbidden. It is unlawful, it is haram. But what about emotionally hurting? Because in reality, you're not physically hurting them. Or is emotionally hurting someone, injuring them emotionally, also forbidden in Islam, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Very nice question. And actually, it's about the how this divine religion of Allah, which is Islam, is encouraging people to have emotionally, you know, gather together and respect each other. And you maybe you cannot imagine how a huge amount of riwayat and narrations of Ahlul Bayt we have about the visiting each other, gifting to each other, be nice, to have nice treatment, you know, to each other, and so on and so forth. Right. For example, we have one narration, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he said that, Ya ma'ashar al-mu'mineen ta'allafu wa ta'atafu. O people of the faith, visit each other, pay respect to each other, and to have nice treatment, kind relationship and interaction to each other. And you know, especially in this day and age, you see how important it is to pay respect to each other and to be kind and right. Nice treatment to each other. Especially, you know, by this modern technology and this isolation of people and individualism, you know, the culture right. of the, unfortunately, some countries. And unfortunately, maybe it's to some extent, it's worldwide that people, they want to have their individual interest and they are looking for their own, you know, interest and
self-interest,
yes. Right. And they do not pay attention and pay respect to each other, to their fellow human being. But in this divine religion of Allah, you see how great emphasis we have about the, you know, to have kind relationship and interaction to each other. And especially talking about the emotional hurting, which is in, you know, in our narration, which we call it hajr, which means in Farsi we say qahr kardan, you know. So kind of emotional hurting to each other. We have in some narrations from Noble Prophet Muhammad, he said that man hajara akhahu sanatan fahuwa kasafku dami. If you hurt emotionally your brothers and sisters in faith, more than 1 year is as if you have, you know, shed their blood. You
right.
see?
Spilled their blood.
Yes, right. You spilled their blood. And it, you know, indicating to the forbiddance of having so long, you know, cut to have so long cutting your relationship with your fellow brothers and sisters.
Right.
And of course, in other narrations, we have that Noble Prophet Muhammad, he said that, La hijrata fawqa thalas. You cannot break your relationship with your faithful brother and sister more than 3 days, actually. And we can understand from these narrations and other, you know, narrations of Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salatu wasalam, peace and blessing of Allah be upon them, that maybe to some extent we can understand more than 3 days of breaking your relationship with your fellow brothers and sisters is to some extent maybe it is forbidden or at least dislike.
So even at this level, just cutting contact or just ignoring them perhaps or not finding the time to answer a phone call for 3 days is actually considered, I'm not going to say haram, of course not, but it is disliked in Islam. So then naturally I would assume that emotionally hurting someone is much more forbidden and punishable in Islam, I think.
Exactly, exactly. Right. You know, it is, you know, dislike, very heavily at actually disliked.
So it's a makruh, certainly.
Yes, yes. And we have in other narration, he said that لا يحل للمؤمن أن يحجر أخاه فوق ثلاثة أيام. More than 3 days, you cannot break your relationship with your faithful brother and sister. You should still be in contact with them, you know, respecting them, paying respect to each other, and to have nice interaction with each other, among each other. And of course, we in other narrations, we have that the if you continue having this kind of relationship, I mean, you know, to have this kind of breaking relationship with your brothers and sisters,
right.
It is